Anyways, okay, so we had just read about the first war with the first and second wars between Ben-Hadad, between Aram and Ahav, and we noted a lot of things that Perek, that Ahav seems to have done a certain level of tshuva.
God helped him.
Well, but also he has this faith in the Navi. Now we're going to see that it's not true in Chof Aleph, and the way Midrashim highlighted is because it's, you know, the worst character in the story is Yezebel, and she's the she gets him to do the worst things that he does. Now the last thing, if you remember, Hashem says he's going to be punished because he didn't kill Ben-Hadad, which the Yerushalmi assumes is because Hashem actually told him to kill Ben-Hadad. But I was reading today Alex Israel's book, and he noted that in the ancient, you know, the ancient world, the end of a war was always a war only ended with regicide, right, when you killed the king. And if you don't, doesn't matter how badly you would beat somebody's army, it wasn't considered a full victory. So it could be that it was just understood that if you have to beat Aram, you have to kill Ben-Hadad. And when he doesn't, it sounds like the reason he doesn't, you find this often, is because it's a class unity, right? That as much as he's faced from Ben-Hadad is a king, he's a king, and he feels for him. And when Hashem says to him through the Navi that he's going to eventually, this will lead to his destruction, it's true, because just a few years later, after the whole truce, Ben-Hadad comes back, because if the only way to signify the end of a war is to kill the king, and you don't, what you're saying is no matter how bad I beat you, right, I don't really think I won, which is enough to give confidence to them to fight again. So it's also a sort of a natural consequence of his weakness.
It actually makes sense that God told him, because God told, I can't remember who, not Eliyahu, to make Hazael the king of Aram, which means that...
But there'll be another... Yeah, and that could be part of the evidence, right? That you were getting rid of this one. So that was where we were up to. Then we get to Perek Chof Aleph. Now, Perek Chof Aleph is one of the most... this is really the lowest point in
It can get lower.
And all because the woman.
What? All because of Yezebel, yeah. Well, Yezebel is really bad. I mean, Alex Israel points this out, that, like, even later on when she gets killed, like, she's totally unrepentant. Even after Hashem says, you're going
to
be killed, and they actually show
Jewish.
Up. She wasn't, right? She's from Sidon.
She's not Jewish.
Well, because it's not just Abu Dazara. It's like, as we'll see, she's just evil, as we'll see here. When they come to assassinate her, right, she doesn't, like, hide. You know, like, Ben-Hadad, this mighty king of Aram, is hiding somewhere. When they come to assassinate Yezebel, she sits there, waits for them, and mocks them. Like, she's till the end. Like, she is not... Like, nothing phases her. She's a character. So, we start off... So, Navot... This guy, he's a guy, right? He has a vineyard next to the palace of Ahav in Shomron. Vayidaber Ahav el Navot lemor. Now, we're going to see that this story, like this dialogue that we're about to see between Ahav and Navot, is going to be repeated four times in like 10 psukim. And what Yair Zakovich points out is that if you want to follow, right, this is a perfect experiment into psychology, because even though we're going to hear this four times, it's going to be four different ways, and you're going to see why it starts spiraling out of control. It's the same conversation, but as they replay it in their minds, it gets worse and worse each time. So it starts off, Vayidaber Ahav al Navot lemor, Tinali et karmecha, vihi li ligan yarak, So Chav says to Navot, can I have your vineyard so I can have it as a garden because it's right next to my palace? I'll give you a better vineyard in exchange, or if you want, I'll pay you the price in money. Right? Now this first dialogue, right, so far Achav, it's extremely respectful. It's for a king to say this, it's very impressive, right? Saying, look, I want to buy it. I will give you good money for it. I'm willing to give you a field. I'm willing to give you money, whatever you want. Whatever you want. Very calm, very respectful, self-effacing. Vayomer Navot Elachav, Chalili Me'adonai, Mititi Nachalat Avotilach. And Avot says to Achav, God forbid that I should give away my father's inheritance to you. Right? So the answer isn't personal. It's religious. It's, look, this is Nachlat Avotai. And as the Psukim make clear, we don't like people selling or giving up their father's inheritance. That's why we have Yovel, that it goes back every 50 years. Because we don't want, everyone deserves his family inheritance, and it's clearly looked down upon to give it up. So he says, look, I don't want to do it. Now, he does say, I'm not going to give it to you, but you is clearly not the emphasis here. It's, really, this would be a sin for me. I don't need the money, and I'm not going to give up my ancestral land, which I'm not supposed to do. Vayavo achav el beito, sar v'za'if al hadavar, asher diber lav ne'avoda Yisraeli. Vayomer lo etein lecha enachlar avotai. Vayishkav amitato vayasev et panav lo achal lachem. And he gets home, and he's replaying this in his head, and he's very upset, because Nabot had said, I won't give you my inheritance, right? And now the lecha is moved to the front, right? It was an afterthought in Nabot. Nabot, clearly, it was chalila mehashem. It's not the right thing to do religiously. By the time Achav repeats it in his head, chalila li mehashem is dropped. There's no religious component. And lecha is moved to the front. I don't want to give it to you, right? It goes from being religious to personal. And he said, so in the meantime, he's so upset by this that he lies down in bed and doesn't eat anything. And Izevel, his wife, comes to him and says, what are you so upset about and why aren't you eating? So he says to her, Ki adaber Navot Yisraeli, right, what he had said to Navot. Va'omer lo, now he's repeating what he'd said to him. Tinali et karmecha bechesef. So now, both conversations have changed. Right? And Alex Israel suggests this is because Achav, we've learned, is somewhat repentant. He can have a nice side to him. Yisevel has no nice side to her till the very end. And she clearly doesn't like. I mean, you saw with Eliyahu, Achav, once he's proved wrong, he makes up with Eliyahu. Yisevel, tell him by tomorrow I'm going to kill him. Right? She doesn't like kings giving in. So this time, when he's repeating what he said, he hardens it, right? Instead of that whole self-effacing speech of, you know, I'd really like to have a garden. It would be really nice. Do you mind? Can I buy it for you? Right? He cuts to the chase and he says, I said to Navot, give it to me, right? And I'll pay you, right? Before he'd say, I want to pay you, right? Can you please sell it to me? When he retells it to his wife, who's much more domineering, he says, I told him, give it to me. And I offered to pay out of the benevolence of my heart. I'm the king. I don't really need to offer to pay at all. I ordered him to give it to me. And I also told him, I'll pay him if he wants. And he said, I won't give it to you. Right? Now there's nothing. It's just, I won't give you my field. Right? It went from religious to
personal.
To personal to insulting. Right? I gave him an order and he refused. But Tomrei Lev Izevel Ishto Ata Tasem Luchal Yisrael Kum Echalechem Vitabli Becha Ani Etein Lachad Kerem Navot Yisraeli. So his wife said to him, "Don't worry, it's time for you to show yourself to be king. Go eat something, be happy, and I'll get it for you." Now, what we're going to see is that he's out of the picture here. But despite the fact that he's out of the picture, once, as we'll see, Izevel has him killed. He's going to be held responsible, which Alex Israel on the footnote notes that this is parallel to what is clearly going on in the Megillah, where Achashverosh is held morally culpable by the Megillah for what's going on in the Megillah, even though ostensibly he doesn't know what's going on, because it's the job of the king to know. Right? You can't get away with this, right? Meaning, she promised him that no matter what, she's going to get him the field. Right. He knows something's about to happen, now he just closes his eyes willingly. If a king does that, right, it's his fault. And that's really, you know, Ahasuerus' Haman thing. Now, in the Megillah, it's much softer because, you know, it's written concealed because Ahasuerus was reading it. Right? But Ahasuerus doesn't come out in a good light, partially because of this, because it is irresponsible for a king who doesn't really want something to happen, or even if he does, to just allow things to happen in his kingdom. But in the meantime, now Achav is out of the story, in at least the person. ותכתוב ספרים בשם אחיו ותחתום בחותמו. ותשלח ספרים אל זקנים ואל אחרים אשר בעירו היושבים אל נפות. So she writes letters in Achav's name and seals them with his seal and sends them to the elders and nobles who lived in the same town as Navot. Right, so it's clear that she's acting in his behalf, and even if he doesn't know exactly what she's up to, he knows, right, he's okay with it. He's giving her full rein to do something which is clearly not right. ותכתוב בספרים לאמור, קירוצום, הושיבו את נבות בראשם. And we talked about this a little earlier, that one of the interpretations of why Isabel had told Eliyahu, I'm going to kill you tomorrow, rather than just going and killing him, was because you need a facade of law. And we saw this, and you see this in Megillah also, mm-hmm. that even though it's fake law, right, even though there's no rhyme or reason to it, you need a cover of law, right? Even the most powerful king needs the cover of law. And that, right, in Megillah, right? And Haman's big idea is, how do we kill Vashti? Really, I'm just killing Vashti because I'm angry at her. But what do? I make a law that anybody who slights their husband, right, that's illegal. And Vashti is just part of that law. I'm going to make a law that will veil the fact that I'm just angry at my wife and I want to find a way of punishing her. The Jews, Mordechai angers Haman, so instead of punishing Mordechai, he comes up with a law which justifies killing the whole nation. Right? They use law, and the same thing happens here. So she's about to use it, and it's clear that everyone understands what's going on, because she's writing this letter to the... It's clear that there's a plot going on, and she tells the elders, I need you to do this for me. I need you to make a fast tomorrow, and I need you to have Navot in front. Voshivu shnaim anashim b'nev liyal negdo v'yudu lemor berachta Elohim v'amelech v'otziyu skulu v'yamot. And she says, get two people, b'nev liyal, people with no moral backbone, to falsely testify that he blasphemed God and the king, and then put him to death. Right, that's her advice. Vayasu, right, and the irony of the whole thing is that this starts off with Navot being very frum. Chalil me Hashem, and he clearly is very devoted. This is ironic. Vayasu anshe iro askenim v'achorim asher shvim b'iro kasher shalcha aleihem Izebel kasher kaduv v'tzvarim asher shalcha aleihem. So they do exactly what Izebel said, what was written in those books that she'd sent. And whatever Izebel tells you, you do. Karutzom v'oshiva Navot b'roshom. So they made a fast, they put Navot in the front. V'yavo shnei anashim v'nei v'liyal v'yishvu negdo v'yidu anshe b'liyal et Navot negen ha'am l'mor Beirach Navot Elohim v'melech v'yitzu michutz la'ir v'yitzkulu b'avanim v'yamot. They come, they testify against him that he committed blasphemy against God and the king. They take him outside and they stone him. V'yishlachu al Izebel l'mor sakol Navot v'yamot. And they go and they tell Izebel it happened, right? It's clear that everyone's in on it, everyone knows this is fake. And still, what's amazing is that the law is apparently important enough that even Izebel, who couldn't care less that people know this is a plot, couldn't care less about what she does, still, she needs a pretext. She needs to do something.
How is this time compared to Mishnah or Gemara?
Well, yeah, in the Mishnah, the Gemara, right, the death penalty is almost never carried out.
So it is before, I guess.
This is way before. But also, it's clear this is a fake court, right? This is a setup.
Tanaim or destruction of the second...
second century of the Common Era. Second to fourth century.
After the destruction of the second...
So much. This is more than 1,000 years. You have 1,000 years to go, right?
Oh, so much.
You know, almost... Yeah, something like that. Something like 1,000 years. But more than that, like, this is not a real court case, right? It's clear to everybody involved. The judges, Izebel, this is a setup. The witnesses...
Why do people know that it's a setup? I don't think.
No,
the
people don't, but the elders that she's contacting know.
Why? Why do they know?
She sent her a letter that they should arrange it.
They should arrange a Yom Din, but it
should. No, and Pazigud, Voshi Shnesh Anashim Bini Blial, right? Get two fake witnesses. This is what she writes to them. Right, Hoshivu, right? That's active. Hoshivu, lefnei shnayim anashim b'nei v'liyal negdo, right? Put two fake witnesses, right? Now, it's not clear. It could be different letters, right? You know, there could be different people involved. But it's clear that...
He says here,
Well, I mean, the big...
Chief Barosh et Navo Dafka Kedei Lehasir Kol Chashat Shekavanat Asifa Hi Leharalo.
Well, they right, meaning that she doesn't want anybody else to know, but it's clear right, at the end, right, normally if you put someone to death, you don't then write a letter to the queen. Right? It's clear that right, the first thing they do when Navot is killed, they write a letter to the queen. Right? It's clear that there's somebody, there's some corrupt, I don't know if it's the whole Sanhedrin, the whole Besna there, but there's clearly a few judges mm-hmm. that are in on it, because they're the ones contacting Yezebel and telling her, by the way, you know, what you wanted is done, he's dead. Again, how much? It's clearly not an open. It's clearly not open. It's somewhat secretive, but she's you know, she's pulling her power with the leaders. Vayichi shmo Yezebel ki sukal navot vayamot vatom Yezebel achav kum reish adakerem navot Yisrael yisher main letet lecha bechesef kein navot chai ki mate. So Yezebel says to Achav, go take the vineyard of Navot, who refused to give it to you even for money, right? And here's the fourth time around, right? It went from frum to personal to he turned down a command to he spite. It was in spite of the king, right? Because right now when she doesn't, the third time around it was a command and he turned it down. The fourth time is here you were so magnanimous you offered to buy it and he didn't even want to sell it to you, right? By the fourth time it's he just snubbed you for the sake of snubbing you. And even though Achav wasn't involved, it's clear that he is responsible because Vayichi Shmo Achav ki made Navot. Vayakom Achav lored et lo kerem Navot Yisraeli rishto. So Achav heard that Navot was dead, and he goes to take it. He doesn't ask any questions. He doesn't ask, well, how did you manage that one? He doesn't ask, well, what did he do? Why does he not have heirs? Right? Why should he go to the king? Right? I mean, like he just hides from all this. He closes his eyes. He knows his wife did something shady. So even if he doesn't know the details, when Eliyahu in a moment is going to hold him responsible for this, it's clear why. Because he willingly was blind to what was about to happen. Vayhi, and this is why when you look at the parak before, where for all his, you know, he's not perfect, but he is somewhat, you know, like Achav, had respect for the people, he asked their opinion, right? By the time he gets here, right, you see, I mean, it's his wife, is, he's happy to go along with it, but he won't do the dirty work, right? Yezebel can get him to do things he wouldn't know. She's particularly bad in this story, I mean, all the stories. What is it?
It's the area of the...
I mean, it's a beautiful area. Vayhi dvar Adonai Eliyahu atishbi lemor. At that moment, Hashem comes to Eliyahu and says, "Kum." It is sort of funny that at this point, even though Eliyahu is supposed to have moved on to Elisha, this is really a job for Eliyahu, which sort of makes sense, right? It's another yelling job, right? This is like, it's his personality. He's okay with this. It's kum reid lekrad achav melech Yisrael sher b'shomron hine becherem navod asher yarad sham lirishto. Go and catch him in the act. Right, catch him as he's going to take the vineyard. Right, this is just like, you know, each time he's met, Achav has been in a particular place. Right, when he met him in the rain one, it was while he was scavenging for the last grass. Right, it was while he was humiliated. Here, it's in the act. Right, catch him there. V'dibart elav lemar ko amar Adonai haratzachta v'gam yarashta.
That's a famous saying.
V'dibart elav lemar ko amar Adonai makom asher lakiku aklavim edam navot yilaku aklavim edam chagam ata. And here you get this pithy, you know, rhyme. Right, haratzachta v'gam yarashta. Right, have you murdered and also inherited and taken possession? And again, it's clear the Torah, the Navi does not even bring Yezebel into it. The king, in the end of the day, has final responsibility. Right, Yoni Grossman uses this, to, as I said, to prove that Ahasuerus is morally culpable for the whole story, because it's clear in the eyes of Tanakh the king is blind willingly to acts of injustice. It's his fault, because in the end of the day, it's with his power. The same with Haman. Right, same as Yezebel. Yezebel, as powerful as she is, she has to sign it with Achav's name. It only works because Achav gave his gushbanka, literally. He gave his stamp away. And Haman is the same way. It only works because Ahasuerus is willing to give away his ring blindly. So tell him, did you murder and take possession? And then tell him that because of that, where the dogs lapped up Navot's blood, the dog will lap up your blood too. Vayomer Achav Eliyahu, Hamitzatani Oivi? Yomer matzati yan hitmakercha la'asod hara b'nei Adonai. He said, have you found me, my enemy? Right? And you see Ahav trying to deflect it. Right? He's trying to make it personal. Right? He implies, right? It's the way that he deals with it psychologically. Because Eliyahu comes and says, you've done something immoral. And he responds, have you come to attack me, my enemy? Right? It's clear he's saying, ugh, you're just saying this. You're just saying this because you don't like me. Which is what he's going to say later on. Because later, there's going to be, during the next war with Aram, when they're looking for a Navi, right? He's going to be looking for a Navi with Yehoshaphat, and they're going to call all the fake Nevi'im. And Yehoshaphat is not going to want it. He's going to say, is there any other Navi? He says, yeah, there's one Navi Hashem, but he never speaks nicely about me. Right? It's personal. He's in this mindset that Nevi'im, it's all personal. So Eliyahu says, yeah, I have found you, because you've committed yourself to doing what is evil in the sight of the Lord. Right? Now, hitmakrut in modern Hebrew is addiction. Right? I mean, you've given yourself, you've sold yourself out. Hineni mevi elecha ra'a uviarti acharecha vichrati l'achav mashtin bakir v'atzur v'azuv b'Yisrael. And I'll bring disaster on you, and I'll make a clean sweep of you, and I'll cut off every male. Right? Mashtin bakir.
Yet is in the halachoshio, no?
Mashtin Bakir.
Yeah.
I think we also had it earlier. We had it in Melachim.
Okay,
right? It's the very crude way. Right? People who urinate against a wall, which is a crude way of saying males. Right? All males belonging to Achav, free men and slaves, will be killed. V'natati et beitcha kivet yiravam benivat ukivet basha venachia elakas asherich asta v'tachti Israel. And I'll make your dynasty like yiravam and basha because of this anger. And now it changes. He doesn't just say, I'm going to punish you. He says, this is the end of your kingdom. Right? Because that's when he says, you're like Yeravam and you're like Basha. That means that as much as God once gave it to you, this is the end of your dynasty. V'gam li'izevel, diber Adonai le'mor, haklavim yochlu et izevel b'chel Yisrael. And Izevel also will be eaten by the dogs in Yisrael. Hamet l'achav ba'ir yochlu haklavim, v'hamet basadeh yochlu of ha'shamayim. Anybody of Achav's line who die in the town will be devoured by dogs. Anyone who dies in the country will be devoured by birds. Rak lo yarcha chavashet maker lasod hara b'nei Adonai asher esato to Izevel ishto. And if you didn't believe me that it was because of Izevel, the pasuk tells you there was nobody as evil as Achav who did what was evil in God's eyes because of his wife had instigated, because of Izevel. Now the Rambam learns from here, why is this? Because there were a lot of people who did Avodah Zarah. And to be honest, the Pesukim never said it. That this Pesuk has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. And the Rambam says, what you learn from here is that as bad as Avodah Zarah is, there's something particularly morally reprehensible, which we all know, about murder. And murder, especially this cold-blooded, calculated murder, is the worst. It's below anything else. And this is why they come down on him and they say, no, he's the worst. He's the absolute worst. It's not the idolatry of Yeravam, but it doesn't matter. It's this cold, calculated murder for a little bit of property, for a vendetta, whatever it is. This is the work, the worst. Then it says, and he acted most abominably, going after all the Avodah Zarah, like the Amori. Now, you could have read this pasuk and said that, you know, it just appears here, but it's really about Avodah Zarah. But the Rambam takes it in context and says, no, the Avodah Zarah is sort of an afterthought. What made him the worst was Avodah Zarah plus murder. Murder is the worst. But here, after this diatribe, you see the duality in Achav. And we've already seen this in Achav. That Achav, for all his evil, he is somewhat receptive. We've, in the few prakim that we've met Achav, we started with him having idol worship and allowing Izevel to create an atmosphere where all the Nevi'i Hashem were killed and all the Nevi'i Habal were on top. One miracle later, and he allows Eliyahu to get rid of the Nevi'i Habal, the Nevi'i Asherah. And the last parak, even though he makes some mistakes, they're clearly Nevi'i Hashem again and they're walking free. And they're back in society. And he listens to them, and he has a relationship with them, right? He is this weird... And the irony of the psukim is that right after it's almost as if the psukim are putting it purposely out of place. Because he's about to do tshuva. But before he does tshuva, it reminds you that he's the worst person ever. Because he goes, minakatzeh lakatzeh, right? He really, on the one hand, yes, he is horrible. And the things he does are worse. And Yizevel is the worst of the worst of the worst. Achav, it's ironic. He personally, there are many moments where you'd be sympathetic with him, where he manages to overcome it. He has a moment of sincerity, of frumkeit. But despite that, the psukim are very, very hard on Achav because of this Navod HaYisraeli. But here you see the tshuva, and you have to figure out, you know, again, why are these psukim of tshuva right after he's the worst? Is it he was the worst and did tshuva, or he is the worst despite the fact that he did tshuva, or he has moments where he's the worst, but he's actually not as wholly evil as some other people? Right? It's very hard to figure it out, but that's the complexity. And the Mefarshim try to grapple with how you deal with it. But when he hears these words, he rips his clothes, he puts sackcloth on his body, he fasted and walks about subdued. Now what's fascinating here is Alex Israel also points this out, I think this is from Rav Salman actually, is there's a nice mini chiasm in this perek that highlights the theme of the perek. It starts with Achav starting to Navot, then Achav talking to Yizevel, then Yizevel dealing with the story of Navot Yisraeli, which is in the center of the book, right? Well, it's really Yizevel talks to the Zkenim, the Zkenim carry out the deed, right? And then the Zkenim talk to Yizevel, Yizevel tells Achav, and Achav now goes gets the field, right? So now we're going backwards, right? But then at the end, so what should be parallel is Achav talks to Navot, and instead Achav talks to Eliyahu, because Eliyahu has now taken the moral voice of Navot is dead. Navot is dead, but Eliyahu is there to be his voice. And what then leads from this is that after he gives him his mussar, he mourns just like he did before. He's not eating. But if you look at the difference, the beginning, he was upset. And it sounds almost passive, right? If you go back to the beginning, he lied down, right? He was just so depressed, he sat in bed all day and he didn't bother to get up to eat. And here, because of his conversation with Navot, he's depressed and doesn't eat. But now, because of his discussion with Eliyahu, he's not depressed. He is doing tshuva. He actively fasts. It's not he lies down and doesn't eat. He tears his clothes and he fasts. It's a tzom, right? It's not lo achalachem. It's vayatzom. And there is that drawing the attention to that is as bad as Achav is, this is intentional, right? And you can see that by the contrast. This isn't just that he's depressed from what Eliyahu has just said, right? That would be one level, to say he believed Eliyahu and now he's just upset, just like he was before. But no, he responds by not eating, but it's a active not eating. I'm going to tear my clothes. I'm going to fast. There is this introspection. There is acceptance of and Eliyahu's Musser. And in response, Vahid Dvar Adonai Eliyahu Atishbi Lemor, Hashem talks to Eliyahu when he says, Haraita ki nechna Achav milfanai? Have you seen that that Achav has humbled himself before me? It's like, as bad as he is, Hashem says, wow, this is real tshuva. There is a moment of contrition. This invokes the David and God moment. Natan.
Well, it's a punishment,
right?
Not in the days of David, but in the days of his kids.
Well, David keeps his kingdom, but yes, meaning it is things that are pushed back a little bit. But he says, "Arita ki nechna acham lefanai, yan ki nechma lefanai, lo avira abi amav, bimei vino avira al beito." Now, Hashem doesn't fully pull it back, because what the crux of the punishment that he got is that you'll be like your Avam and Basha, meaning your kingdom will end. And he still tells him that's going to happen. Your kingdom is still over. There isn't going to be no future. The reprieve, meaning you haven't done enough tshuva that I'm going to forgive you.
Not in your days, but your
kingdom. Right. Meaning, on a personal level, you won't see it. You'll be killed, but you won't see the loss of your kingdom. But the main punishment, but the tshuva isn't enough to undo the crime and undo all the crimes of Achav and Izebel. It's not enough to justify him keeping his kingdom. What it's enough is to spare Achav the personal pain of having to witness it, which is something. It's clearly something. But this is the complexity of Achav, that on the one hand, the Psukim highlight him as evil. He really is evil.
I don't understand why they weren't trying to be the best they could to get their kingdom going. That's what I struggle with.
Right, and that's the thing, you know, we've seen over and over again is that the Navi goes out of its way to present everything as black and white. But for as bad as Omri and Achav are, Omri and Achav are the most powerful kings we've had. Right, that's the thing, is from Navi's perspective, you see it, oh, it's black and white. How could Achav not see the truth? But Omri and Achav built these superpowers, and Achav just beat Ben-Hadad. Like, he has no reason to think things
still,
are bad.
They were idol-worshipping. He took a non-Jewish wife.
Well, that's exactly the point. Part of his power comes from that, because he makes an alliance with Sidon. It's not just parenthetical. It's not like, oh, he was a powerful king and he happened to marry a non-Jewish woman. It's he's powerful because he married the princess of Sidon and forged a relationship, but in part of forging a treaty with Sidon is bringing in idols, right? And that's why, you know, when you wonder, why didn't he ever do tshuva? The answer is because as much as he believes in the Nevi'im, as much as he has these moments of sincerity, it's really hard if, from your perspective, the reason that you're successful is because you are married to an idol worshiper, a woman, and she brings the power with her. She brings Sidon along. And we'll see that after him, after he's killed, they end up warring with Sidon, because once you assassinate the queen, who's the daughter of the king, you go from being allies to being enemies. Right? It really does... The religious revolution comes with political weakness. So it really is hard. This is, and the Navi tries to oversimplify it so that we will understand the moral and religious messages, but for someone living there, it's really hard. It's almost counterintuitive, everything the Nevi'im are saying.
For me, just, we all tzaddikim compared to Achav.
Oh, yes.
And he still got away. He wasn't really punished because he was dead. Why did he care?
I mean, he gets killed, but...
Okay, but he
can't... Kids.
He doesn't see...
Well, they do care, but they do care, right? He cares about having a kingdom.
He killed all the Nevi'im. He had Avodah Zarah. He killed Navot. And he still got off the hook somehow.
And again, that's the thing, is the Nevi'im
so
tried to...
how bad are we? Not really.
Well, that's the thing, is the Nevi'im tried to oversimplify it, right? You're right, meaning... The crazy thing, the people living there would have said, like, look, you know, he died in war, he died a battle, you know, as a warrior, he died an honorable death in war, so his son lost it, but he was such a warrior, you know, he beat Ben-Hadad twice, so he lost the turn of them around, but he won twice, he's so impressive, and it's really hard to feel it, that he was that bad. But yeah, you know, like, he is the worst of the worst, and we're compared, you know.
We are holy.
Oh, for compared to him, yeah, and that's you know the point. I mean, look, in this case, you don't have to guess. The Psukim say he's the worst. He's the worst. Now, other people will be worse than the worst. Menashe will be even worse, but he's pretty bad. Okay, but anyways, that's the extremely depressing parak of that. But we actually have one parak left. The next parak is the last parak of Malchum Aleph.
We should get for dinner.
Even though technically it's all one big book, it's all really Malchum.
Shall we go for dinner? See you.
See him.
What
Let's see, next Wednesday night. Oh, it'll be our anniversary. Oh, look at that.
Can we take you out?
And my birthday.
You think they want to go?
Yeah. And that's on my...